ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Finding out you have cancer can be terrifying. Although treatments are better these days and advances are being made every day, it brings you face to face with some difficult truths. Illuminating discoveries can happen too, though. I'd love to hear from you on this. What has cancer taught you? Peter Goldsworthy is an Australian author and a GP, and his latest book, of many, is a memoir called The Cancer Finishing School, Lessons in Laughter, Love and Resilience. Peter, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Hilary.
It's a pleasure. How much experience of cancer did you have before your own diagnosis, just through working with people as a GP?
Oh, look, that'd be in the hundreds. I've been a bit GP for 40 years, mostly part-time, because I've had, you know, had the two kind of trades, the medicine and literature, but no, all GPs deal with cancer from go to woe, really. And so a lot of, and some of those stories I've used in the book from years past, patient stories are often more interesting or maybe more cautionary or exemplary, anyway, with more lessons in them sometimes, I think, than perhaps my own little story.
Or is it just easier to see the lessons when you've got a bit of distance?
Yeah, probably is. I mean, part of the book is certainly with my diagnosis, which and it did have its comical aspects and ironic, maybe coincidental aspects. And certainly when I first was told or was suspected, my defence mechanism, I think, which was, certainly an original defence mechanism, but maybe a doctor's, is Dr. Reiter's. I'm lucky to have it. You know, what better material? So that sort of seemed to work very well as a defence mechanism against anxiety.
That was really interesting. I love how you said, yes, you know, I'm aware that this was probably a form of denial, but it was such a weird and interesting response. And I guess that's the thing, isn't it? You assume so much about what it would be like to hear that you have cancer, but it's going to hit people in different ways, isn't it?
Well, certainly. Look, I suppose for a doctor, you're lucky in another sense. You know, I mean, lucky is an interesting word to use in this context, but it holds no mystery or, you know, terrors for you. You know exactly what's going to happen. So there's no unknowns. Perhaps that's the word I'm groping for, you know, for a doctor anyway, who's seen this, you know, hundreds of times over 30, 40 years.
Did you ever think at any of those points over the years, Peter, I wonder if this will be me one day?
I kind of, but you know, not to any great extent. I suppose I knew it probably would be me. I mean, I'm fairly fit, you know, from a cardiovascular point of view. And, you know, the big three still really are cancer, heart disease and probably strokes. And I didn't think I'd get the other two because I don't, you know, all my risk factors there are pretty good and I've always kept fit. So, and if you live long enough, you know, though, as you were saying earlier, Hilary, the treatments are so much better now for many cancers and some are, you know, actually curable, a lot of them. But the rate's still going up because people are living longer. And if you live long enough, you will get cancer, even if it takes you to 130, which is probably coming in, you know, my grandchildren's generation.
Yeah, that's a strange idea, isn't it? We're speaking with Peter Goldsworthy, who is a GP. He's had a lot of experience with the medical side of dealing with cancer, and he's an author as well. So as you heard, when he got his own diagnosis, his mind immediately leapt to, how can I write about this? And he's done it in a memoir called The Cancer Finishing School. And I'm very keen to hear from you today too about the perhaps surprising discoveries you made about what you were learning the longer you sat with cancer or helped someone else through cancer. Let's go to Brent in Perth. Hi, Brent.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks. I'm pleased to hear that you've been cancer-free for a period now, but tell us what you learnt during that time.
Well, when most people get diagnosed, the world just seems to stop. You are always sort of focused on your next scan and your next treatment. But the thing is, I probably learned was you just sort of take time to sit back and smell the roses. You appreciate things a lot more, the small things, your family, your friends, because the old saying goes, if you haven't got your health, you haven't got much, you know?
Well, that must have been quite startling, Brent, to see the things that you thought were important before just drop away.
Yeah, well, you know, when you run your own business and you're so busy, you're always rushing to the next thing because everyone's just so busy in life. But when that gets taken away and all you're doing is, especially when you're in treatments, and some of the treatments are pretty pretty harsh. You spend a lot of time at home and around your loved ones, and then you can see the effect that rolls onto them as well, you know. So it's more involved than just the person who has cancer. Your loved ones, your close ones are also heavily affected.
Yeah. Well, and so, Brent, 9 months cancer-free now. That's great to hear. How do you feel that you and your family are looking at life now? Do you find that you're able to kind of go back a bit to the way you felt before, or have you retained that sense of that preciousness?
I think life is precious. When you don't realize, when it can be taken away so quickly, so I think it's when you realise how precious it is. But when you are going through treatment, you're not sort of thinking too far ahead. You're always, but now I can start to plan things and look forward to the future and start sort of, you know, just progressing with my life again, you know.
I'm really glad to hear that, Brent. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us from Perth.
That's all right. No problem.
Cheers.
Have a good day.
You too. Peter, I was struck by what Brent was saying about that narrowing of focus, because you found that too, didn't you? You talked about the necessary narcissism of illness.
Yeah, look, listening to Brent, I think he summed up where this book sort of ends up. I wonder if you need a whole book to get there. But certainly, look, the perspective and, you know, the way the family and loved ones circle the wagons around you, and I think the obvious, I mean, they're almost cliches, but everyone gets there, I think, if they survive, gets to that point where they emerge, you know, determined not to take, you know, so many wonderful things for granted. Determined to make the most of, you know, what's left, or to begin life again in a much more maybe intense sort of carpe diem sort of way, but certainly appreciating things that maybe, you know, they'd been on the back burner. As Brent was saying, if you're too busy with work or whatever, and you just don't want to, you know, overlook those things again, those really important things. I think, you know, Brent too is obviously lucky to have, I mean, many of my patients have been on their own through this, and this one particularly poignant story in the book. And I find it, I don't know how people cope, you know, without loved ones around them of whatever variety or number.
I love the line you wrote, Peter. The pillowed head that I wake beside each morning has never seemed more dear. It just sounds like it brought those family and loving relationships into such sharp focus.
Yes, no, it does do that. And, I mean, you know, politicians are always, you know, when they're stabbed in the back politically, they're always saying, I'm going to spend more time with the grandchildren or whatever, you know. But, gee, that's one. I mean, I'm very lucky to have, you know, the children, grandchildren as well. And as well as having, well, Lisa is sort of the co-star of this book, you know, who came up with the title, actually, The Cancer Finishing School, which is a joke in itself. I mean, I do believe, it's interesting what you were saying later on, you've got a comedian on. This is a full of dark humour as a kind of, I believe humour is a very useful alternate natural therapy, you know, myself. Yeah.
Yes,
but not in all situations, obviously, you know, sometimes if you're in the middle of chemo or, you know, mutilating surgery, whatever, you know, jokes are a little bit beyond you.
Well, yes, range. I look forward to discussing with you in a moment the particular animal your wife suggested replacing you with. But before that, I noticed that our switchboard has just exploded. So let's take a couple more calls as we chat with Peter Goldsworthy today. And a text too. My husband and I both had cancer scares in 2022. The upshot is that it really has shifted our outlook on life. We're very conscious of not putting things off. We appreciate each other and our family life more than ever. And we take small holidays every few months rather than waiting a year to take a bigger one. It's a cliche, but we really are living our best lives after seeing how quickly things can change. And we heard that from Brent before too. Lucy's in Brisbane. Lucy, what were the things that became clear for you?
Well, this is my identical twin sister that I lost over 10 years ago now, although it never does feel like 10 years. I think watching her journey was like thinking that everyone does it in their own different way. You know, while we might say, you know, you need to face things, for her, she didn't want to ever say it was going to happen, even though her death was inevitable for her. So I struggled with that because I wanted to talk about it in a different way. But palliative care got me through that so well. The team of palliative care got me through it and got her through dealing with it. And she kept a gratitude diary, and it was made into a little photo book because she did photos as part of her gratitude diary. And it just made you think it's the smallest things in life. And it was her realising that, you know, people were there for her. Her marriage fell apart while she was in remission, but the strength of people that came back into her life were her people that hadn't seen her for 20 years, out of the blue realized, found out about it and were there for her. Her flight attendant friends would get off a long haul trip and come over and sit with her. And we just became completely back to our childhood bonding. Just everything that might have been between us fell away. And all of the gratitude you have for people rather than things is there in your life.
It sounds like it was a really clarifying moment. And Lucy, as you say, you know, the loss never goes away. Do you still feel able to kind of tap into that sense of gratitude that she was displaying?
Yeah, it takes me when I'm dealing with, ironically, my sister-in-law passed away very suddenly with cancer, like 14 days from diagnosis to dying.
Wow.
Just before Christmas, which has been shocking for everyone. But I think sometimes my perspective is to think, I know that she's been saved a lot of suffering in some respects. You know, no one would have picked it to happen like that, but it's, I look at the other journey, and a different journey that my twin sister had, and thought, you know, there's a lot of trauma in dealing with the suffering as well. So, I think it does help. And just knowing how special your close family are to you, and to take them for granted every day.
Yeah, that's a really useful lesson, isn't it? Lucy, thanks so much for your call.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. I'm loving hearing these stories of what cancer has taught you. Peter, it's interesting, isn't it? You wrote a fair bit about, that question of why has this happened to me? And you came up with some interesting ideas about that. At one point you wrote that perhaps you thought you deserved this. Can you expand on that for us a bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I'm not given to spooky thoughts. I mean, in the book I have prayed once in my adult life when my son was in intensive care, this is, you know, a long time ago now, in London, and wasn't expected to survive the night. And the feeling of powerlessness and just sort of vomited the prayer out of me. But, you know, I don't think prayer can change anything except in our heads, in our own heads. But a lot of people have prayed for me, and I regard that as an act of love. You know, I won't eschew that. But I don't think it's going to help my cancer. But but in answer to the question, we're all prone to magical thinking, and in all kinds of circumstances, it's a deep hardwiring in our brain, I think. But, you know, trying to come up with explanations that might work. Certainly, I felt in particular, I've had an extraordinarily lucky life. And, you know, apart from a spell in intensive care myself when I was about 19, lucky to be born, you know, in a country where you get these medications, you know, anyone gets them, that cost, in other countries you might have to sell your house or not get them at all. So I thought, well, firstly, I thought maybe it's a bit of an evening up of the cosmic luck, the accidental luck. But then I remembered one 2 a.m., a patient of mine, and this sort of shocked me a little bit. It had bothered me at the time, but I'd forgotten about it, and it must be 10, 15 years ago. Probably the biggest mistake I've made in medical, my GP life, I think. There may be others, but this one I did remember at the time, and it was a case of myeloma, which is the cancer I've got, a blood cell cancer. And I was very late in diagnosing him, and I thought, jeepers, you know, if you told me, you offered me a plot of a novel, you know, doctor misdiagnoses a particular cancer, then 10 years later gets the same cancer, I wouldn't have believed the coincidence. And so I thought, well, you know, I mean, I don't believe there's any connection, but it is a kind of accidental karma, if a coincidental karma, and that's something I sort of had to think about a bit too.
Well, and you draw on the work of many other writers throughout the course of this memoir, Peter, and one of them is Joan Didion with her fantastic book, The Year of Magical Thinking. Did you find magical thinking popping up at other points during your time with cancer?
Oh, only generally in an ironic sense, but I mean, I'd take it ironically and go and buy a lottery ticket on the strength of a coincidence. But I mean, the diagnosis was interesting that I'd had a knee that needed replacement from, you know, playing too much football, soccer, and all my life. And so I had a ACL replacement at 35 and then went on playing for another 20 years. That was a silly idea. And so it finally needed replacing, and I thought the medial meniscus had gone in the knee, and I wrote my own little referral, query MM, which is medical shorthand for medial meniscus. And I went around the corner to my friendly neighbourhood radiologist, Sean Fowler, and had an MRI. And he called me in his office, as is his wont with me, and said, look, Peter, you know, it's bone on bone, you need a replacement, but the marrow looks a bit weird, you know, the bone marrow. He said it could be multiple myeloma, which is also MM in, you know, medical case note shorthand. So I said, oh, come on, Sean, I just put the idea into your head. And no. So, you know, I sort of went home on my crutches and went into the and bought a lottery ticket on the strength of that one. And,
as you do.
But I thought, you know, the cosmic trickster has been, there have been a lot of playing jokes on me, and there were a few more through there. Another one was my younger daughter, who's a psychiatrist, her and a physio friend set up a wonderful business in Adelaide called Lift Cancer Services, which offer like gyms and physio and psychological support and dietary support and, you know, even like, anyway, and when they set this up, they invited Lisa and myself, or asked Lisa, if we could come down and be pretend cancer patients for the photo shoot for their website, right? And so, I mean, this sounds so. There, we were out. Funny enough, I was diagnosed the Friday before Father's Day. I told Lisa on the Friday, and I said, well, the kids were taking us out for lunch on Saturday, Sunday, and. I said, maybe I won't tell them. And she said, well, that's a ridiculous idea. You know, how can we sit there? How could I sit there? So we told them. And then after, you know, we'd gone through all that, you know, all the quite moving process that was, but it ended up, you know, with more jokes, like, you know, my son saying, well, Dad, you go to any extreme to be the centre of attention at Father's Day. And that kind of, so we got there. It took a while to get there, but we got there. But then suddenly, Lisa said, to Alex, who my younger daughter, are we still on your website, you know, as cancer patients? And everyone's Googling, and there we were. They had a couple of actors came in as well. And Alex said to Lisa, don't worry, Lisa, we'll Photoshop you out before the curse strikes again.
Oh, dear. Finally, we're telling truth in advertising. That's good.
Yeah, so there was another kind of very, you know, okay, you could say that's, I mean, the magical, there's no real magical thinking there, but there's sort of what would you call ironic magical thinking. But certainly with Joan Didion, it's a very funny story. I tell him there when we went to have lunch with Joan at her apartment, but that's kind of a separate story to but there is a lesson in that story as well. The opening of the Year of Magical Thinking has some of the best, most beautiful writing about denial, that you know, ancient defence mechanism I was talking about before, ever written. I mean, it's a wonderful thing there where she says she can't throw his clothes out, especially his shoes, because she said, well, what will he wear when he comes back?
Yes, and, it's an incredible
that
book,
kind
isn't
of,
it?
It's a very profoundly moving book. Yeah.
Let's hear from some more of our listeners, Peter Goldsworthy, because there are a lot of people wanting to chat with us today about the lessons of various kinds that cancer has brought. Adrian's in Castle Hill. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, g'day, guys. How are you going?
Good. What's your thought?
My experience with my sister who suffered, you know, through cancer and passed away just before Christmas 2021. And I could see where Peter, you know, when you mentioned about people pray for him, I gathered he doesn't believe in God, which is his choice. Mm-hmm. But she was strong in her faith, and she was so brave because of that. What I found, it does, you know, change the perspective if you've had some sort of a real serious issue that you've had to overcome, a health issue. But, and make you realise, you know, the importance, especially what's really important. The problem with this country and with people is, you know, one thing's getting worse, and that's greed, and the other thing that's getting less is gratitude. People just don't have gratitude and aren't thankful for what they got. And I've gone through a few things that's made life a bit tougher, and they're all just challenges for me to make me better.
Yep. Yeah, that's a really good perspective to share. Thank you, Adrian. Sarah's in New South Wales too. Sarah, in remission now, what did you bring from that experience?
I brought that I didn't realise how much I was loved, I don't think, by by the people that I come into contact with over the years through work or our children or volunteering, whatever it was. We were just snowed under by cards and letters. We did have an answering machine, and every day there would be messages on it. If people knew they couldn't get through, I just couldn't face the phone, and in the end neither could my husband. Meals would turn up on our doormat, and sometimes we didn't know who they were from. It was just, it was overwhelming, and the support went on right through chemotherapy, and our children were supported too. I could see that happening by the school community and friends and family, and it's just so humbling. And I just feel for people who perhaps have recently moved to a new community and don't have connection, I can't imagine what that would be like, you know, not to have that support from people, you know, even people that hadn't seen or spoken to for quite some years, you know.
Yes, because it's not just that inner circle, is it, Sarah? It sounds like it's the rings of the community around you.
No, it is. And sometimes it was people that were not so close or that you hadn't seen for years, but they understood because they'd been touched in some way themselves or a family member. I think when you know and you've joined that club, you get it and you go, well, it's time. I know what to do. I know what they need, you know.
Yeah, love through food is a lovely thing, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah. One more thing I learned, and this was kind of a side thing to, you know, the whole pink breast cancer thing was, you know, well underway when I was diagnosed 13 years ago, was this, people would use this language of you've got to fight, and there became almost like a sense of, you know, and doing these walking rallies and things, which I think are wonderful to raise awareness, etc. But we have to be careful with our language, I think, and I learnt that I am not here today because I was braver than someone else. You know, I was here because I had great treatment, I had a lot of support, and I was probably lucky. And I think we've got to be careful with our language. It's not just about the will to live. Mm. Everyone wants to live.
Yeah.
And I try and be careful about that, you know.
That's really interesting, Sarah. Thank you for raising that, because I wanted to ask you that, Peter. There's often a very kind of individualistic language around it, you know, the will to live, the fighting the battle. What's your perspective on that? Because some people find that that militaristic language actually quite useful. Like it helps firm their resolve to you know, deal with all the things you do have to deal with during treatment.
Yes, look, I think, sorry. I certainly think that can help our stoicism, our backbone. I mean, there's a book, Susan Sontag, I kind of criticise it a little bit in there, called Illness's Metaphor, and she really didn't like, it was published a long time ago, really didn't like the metaphoric use of cancer, you know, battles against cancer, but it is a battle, and, you know, and we need, you know, if we can, that we need, that can help to give us some kind of extra ammunition, I think. But, you know, getting back to Adrian, I think also, as far as, although I might be an atheist, you know, my sister's a devout Christian and my brother-in-law, and the other grandmother of some of my grandchildren is a devout Muslim, and they've all told me they're praying for me. And I, you know, I love that. I regard that as an act of love. And also, of course, religion is still, you know, one of the great sustainers of people in these, you know, in extremists, and I would never, and I've also encouraged my patients who are believers. There's one story in the book, I think one of my patients comes in one day and says, Peter, what's wrong with you? And an elderly lady, and I say, well, what do you mean? And she said, Father John was praying for you the other day down at the nearby Catholic church. And she said, and as I sort of explained to her, I've got a cancer, and she said, well, I hope it's going to be fixed. I need you to see me out.
Think about your responsibilities.
Exactly.
Wow. We're speaking with Peter Goldsworthy, who's a GP, which clearly carries great responsibilities. With great power comes great responsibility. But he's also a writer, and he's put his own experience with cancer into the service of literature and memoir in this case. It's called The Cancer Finishing School. I was struck by what some of our callers have been saying too about the needing a village, Peter, because it sounds like there was a village for you when you were going through some pretty full-on treatment. How many people were on that roster?
Well, and they say we because it goes back to hunter-gatherer times. I think they say we, you know, with them they were movable villages, nomadic villages, but they were usually 100, 150, I think, is the kind of approximate clan size. And you realise, I mean, you've got your immediate family, and I have a lot of that, but friends. And when I was in isolation after my stem cell transplant for a few months, and there was a period I had to have someone with me, and Lisa she'd reduced her role, which was dean at the University Senior College here, and was just teaching more part-time, but she still needed to work. And what you the last person was saying, but you realise how many people you loved you. And friend, I mean friends now, with the rosters drawn up of neighbours, fellow writers, friends, and I found that very moving, and that wonderful support. And I mean, sometimes you kind of you feel you just want to get away from the love for a while, but you go up pretend you need a sleep or whatever. But that sounds churlish. But no, wasn't my overriding feeling at all. I sometimes feel like I was a bit tired to make conversation. But but that was they all knew that as well.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? You hope that people will understand that you'll be having a lot of different emotions and reactions. But this text is illuminating too. Anne from Melbourne says, "I found during melanoma treatment, my family reacted in a worrying way. My partner assumed I would die and passed this on to our children. I ended up trying to lessen the burden on everyone. I discovered I am more resilient than my partner." And I think that that's a really interesting thing, because cancer can teach us things about ourselves and others that we did not expect in various ways. Did you want to react to that, Peter?
Oh, I think there's no doubt. Look, it's not just a disease. Since one of your callers earlier mentioned, it's a family. It's a disease of your family. You know, everyone's going through things, and often more than you are. And certainly, I think that was often the case with me. I had kind of naturally a natural optimist, and also I knew I wasn't ever anxious about anything that was happening. And I was more curious in a way, and that's partly being a doctor, I think. So I know that it was terrifying for, you know, like Lisa and at times for my children, maybe not my second daughter, who's also a doctor, but a psychiatrist so much. But so I agree entirely with that. And to be surrounded by it, to be in a village, even if you at times I feel like the village idiot, it's a wonderful feeling. And even within our big cities, we do live within that village of friends and family.
Well, yes, and I love how you talk about the little moments of humour when your optimism and your humour came through, and you just suggested that your wife should replace you with a pet at one point. Why did you do that?
Well, that was a lovely story about one of my former patients, who was a Uniting Church minister, and he was a hero of mine. I think I say in the book he attained sainthood during the protracted ordeal of his wife's illness, bowel cancer, and then finally death. But about 6 weeks later, he came into the surgery almost jauntily and said, "Well, I've replaced it with a budgie." And I said, lost for words a bit. I said, "Oh, what do you call a budgie?" He said, "Jeremiah." And I was trying to cheer Lisa up with this story when she was worrying about me. And she said, "Are you suggesting I should replace you with a budgie? And what shall I call the new you?" And I said, "Ishmael," which is kind of a literary joke to do with maybe Dick, but the novel, which starts with the line, "Call me Ishmael." But it worked, and she laughed. So.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. There's much to mine there, Peter Goldsworthy. I wish we had the time, maybe on another day. Let's check in with our callers as well. We've got a few minutes left here on Life Matters, and I'd love to hear your stories about what lessons cancer has taught you, whether that's your own or one that you've helped or watched someone you love go through. Corinne's in Bellingen in New South Wales. Hi, Corinne.
Hi.
Hi. Now, you're in remission now. What have you brought out of that experience of having cancer and then being free of cancer?
Well, I've got an incurable cancer, so yes, I am in remission now, and hopefully I will be for a long while. But I just want to say that nature was really a big thing for me going through my journey, and still is. I just find walking on the beach with the dog, sitting at home watching the birds, being out in nature has been profound, really, and it's really the word gratitude comes, like the other speakers have talked about. The gratitude of just being alive and having every day as a blessing, really.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Thank you, Corinne. And Peter, I was struck by... sorry, go on.
I was going to say gratitude. It seems to be an emerging theme. And there's a beautiful little book some of your readers will know Oliver Sacks wrote when he was dying called Gratitude. And it's just four short, almost like four last songs. And I do talk about Sacks, who I knew a little, and that book, which I took with me into hospital when I was having my stem cell transplant. It's a beautiful book.
I love how you name drop various friends. Oliver Sacks, Joan Didion had lunch. Clive James, your wonderful friend Clive James. I remember his poem, one of the poems he wrote as he was contemplating his own death, and the long period between his diagnosis and his death seems to have really sharpened his sense of beauty in the world and senses. And that sounds like it happened for you too, Peter, that you were starting to appreciate things more in the sensory realm.
Yeah, and this kind of the metaphor for that, I think, was because of the high-dose steroids I was on, I developed cataracts at sort of warp speed and then had them removed. And look, there'll be thousands of your listeners out there who've had this experience. Suddenly the world has a whole new depth and fine detail, a texture and a colour, a technicolour that maybe you'd forgotten about. It had been so long ago you'd seen it like that. And I think that works as a metaphor for not just, you know, sight, but for a lot of the senses and the experiences when you emerge from this ordeal.
That emergence is an interesting metaphor, like chrysalis-like. Let's go to Nicola in regional New South Wales. Nicola, hello.
Hi there.
What illuminations did cancer bring you?
I had my diagnosis, biopsy and diagnosis, and the suspicion of the cancer all sort of happened in 4 hours. Very, very quick process, and into surgery 3 days later for aggressive invasive cancer. And in that time, I sat there and I distilled everything to two words, which I went home and printed and put on the wall. And it was live and love. And I mean, give love to other people, give love to the universe, give love to creation. Just, I wanted to just transmit that love. And I found that more galvanizing, uplifting, and promoted optimism than the thoughts of war and battle. And I shed all of that negativity. I just wanted to be a vessel of light and love.
And so, Nicola, has it been possible to kind of bring that into your everyday life on an ongoing basis? Because sometimes it's such a strong realisation at the time, isn't it? And then it begins to fade.
Well, I bought 50 acres and I'm returning it back to nature.
So you're living that mantra.
And I watched dragonflies and I watched the native birds return on what was once an overgrazed paddock. So it's a wonderful metaphor of regeneration.
Wonderful stuff. Thanks so much for that call, Nicola.
Thank you.
Lovely text coming through too. Andy in Canberra says, I've had cancer 5 times and it's made me vegan and taught me to meditate and appreciate every day. Hooray, he says. A funny memory though, he says, was having huge bull ants clamber all over my feet without biting me because the chemo made me too toxic and unappetizing. And Peter, I loved reading about it sounds weird to say, but the treatment you had, the stem cell transplant, among other treatments, was pretty intense. But I loved reading about how you said it led to a kind of emotional rebirth as well. Your body had to kind of relearn about germs. But what was the emotional rebirth about?
Well, I think, certainly I had zero emotions for some time. It seemed to be, I mean, with a stem cell transplant, you kind of, well, at least I was. I don't think mine was, there are many that are much worse than mine and others that have an easier path with a stem cell transplant, I think. But I was sitting there bald-headed and wearing nappies for some time. And then you're about to start the baby schedule of immunisations exactly according to the blue book at 6 months, and then it goes on for a couple of years. So you are reborn. Your stem cells are reborn. But as taste and texture came back into the world, I mean, I couldn't taste food or, for instance, and wasn't interested to listen to music or reading for long periods. There's a very narrow emotional bandwidth. And then, well, I think when I just felt, I mean, it's not really connected physiologically perhaps, but as I kind of grew back and maybe this big, lying there like this big baby, starting to taste the world again, and it just seemed so much more magical and intense, and than before. And emotionally, I felt, well, much more prone, surprised by emotions that maybe I would have been suspicious, more suspicious of before, like sentimentality, and for instance. And so it all washed back in, and it was lovely. And that's something I, you know, particularly love. We always come back to that, and that's been another theme that people have been talking about this morning, I guess.
Yes, indeed. Well, I want to finish with Michael from Port Macquarie in New South Wales. Michael, welcome to you.
Oh, hi, Hilary. How are you?
Good. What's your take home from this terrible thing?
Well, I guess acts of kindness and the depths of feeling. In my work too now, my relationships with my clients have a deeper understanding, so that actually helps me. I was always a good communicator, but the cancer that I went through with my wife for 28 years, sorry, of a 30-year marriage, also a stem cell transplant, Hodgkin's lymphoma, breast removal, it's taught me just to be much kinder to the people around me.
That's a wonderful note to end on, Michael. Thank you. And Peter Goldsworthy, just before we let you go, I want to note that your cancer, like Corinne's, is termed an incurable cancer. How do you feel now about the idea of, as you put it, saying goodbye to yourself when that time comes?
I guess, well, part of me is, still thinks I'm going to live forever. I mean, the reborn baby is just hitting adolescence, I think, and so you're indestructible. But, it's going to happen to all of us, and I'm quite sanguine about that. It's that doesn't hold any fear for me, and that when it happens, I mean, when with some of these blood cell cancers that are incurable, remission is always intermission or often intermission, but there's always another drug when one, stops working, and there are more coming down the pipeline all the time. So one thing, this hope is something I can recommend, I mean, obviously, and it can be incurable for a long, long time. I've already outlived the initial five-year survival rate then, and it's five-year survival rates are always looking back in time, and things are changing fast in the whole cancer landscape. I've had two or three friends die of myeloma, before and since I've been ill, but I have another friend who's had it for 20 years. And these things are worth hoping.
Yes,
and
if it's
your particular, palliatives, praying too. I think praying helps our own heads and helps our loved ones' heads, because it is an act of love.
Yep.
But I mean, I don't think it changes the course of cancer though.
Peter Goldsworthy, it's been fascinating speaking with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
No, look, it's been wonderful to be here, Hilary, and good luck and good hope to all the people who called in and other people who are listening out there.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for calling in too and sharing your stories with us. We appreciate it. Peter Goldsworthy's latest book is The Cancer Finishing School, Lessons in Laughter, Love and Resilience.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.